Call your sons, call your daughters, call your friends, call your neighbors.
You gotta be kidding me.
Way back, he looks up, you can't put it on the board. Yes! Yes!
720 WGN, it's White Sox Weekly. Great to be with you this Saturday evening, and even greater to have one of the greatest announcers, one of the greatest men in the history of the game with us, Ken Hawk Harrelson. He's got the book out, Hawk, I Did It My Way. And Hawk, I got to be honest, when the Sox came to WGN, one of the things I was most excited about was talking to you. And I hate that you're leaving. I wanted you, and take this in the best way possible, I did want you to die in the booth. Yeah, any is there any way we could get a reconsideration? Because that I loved when you would say that. I'm like, that's exactly right. He loves his job. That's where it should end. Because you know you've really just given so much to the game and so much to Chicago.
Canerico at the plate here. That ball hit hard, way back. At the wall. He looks up. You can put it on the board.
You gone. Hawk, you know, you've been in baseball since before you were born, and you know, now we've only seen you for last year. It was just a little bit of Hawk. This year, it's even less Hawk. How are you getting along not being at the park as often as you've been?
Well, it's an adjustment. There's no question about that. You know, this is my 42nd year announcing and my 56th year in the game, and you know, your metabolism, we're creatures of habit, and all of a sudden, you know, there for a while, I was thinking about retiring, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, but I married a Greek, and I had nothing to say about it, because if you marry a Greek, you lose a lot of your masculinity, you know, and I said, honey, I'm thinking about retiring. She said, no, you're not. So, yeah, I'm having some trouble adjusting. I've gotten my grandsons to watch play. I couldn't watch them today. But both of them are good players. One's 11, one's 14. And the 14-year-old's as big as I am. I mean, these kids today, I mean, they're getting better and better. And both of them, these guys, as I said, in basketball and baseball, both of them, they can play the game. So that's going to help. But it's still an adjustment. You know, I get up in the morning on the day of a day game, and all of a sudden, you know, I got nothing to do. I got to sit here. I can watch Walker, Texas Rangers, you know. And I can have a couple of pops of Smirnoff. But it's just, it's different. Let's put it that way.
Well, I think it's a challenge for anybody, you know, in your age bracket, Hawk, because you had a phenomenal career, and you extended it for a long time, and then now you're in like the third, and what are you going to do? I mean, you're not going to work forever. I mean, I think you should be at the park all the time as an ambassador, because you love talking to people, and people love talking to you, and who can represent the White Sox better than you can? So I hope you're going to be around. Do you plan to do something along those lines? Obviously, it's not the same as calling the game, but I think being at the park would be – I would assume you'd enjoy it, and I know the fans would.
Yeah, I'm going to. I'm going to be there, and you know, come January 1st, 2020, that'll be the start of all the parts of 8 decades that I've been in professional baseball. And so Jerry and I were talking. He said, heck with that. He said, let's go for 9. Okay. So, you know, I'm going to be around the park, as you just alluded to. I love talking baseball, and I love talking White Sox baseball with White Sox fans. So that will be a new part of my regimen. That'll be a new part of my routine. And then between, you know, Scott Reifert, Bob Graham, and Christine, what we're going to try to do also, we hadn't talked about it, just on the surface we have mentioned it, but maybe, you know, next year and the year after and the year after that, get a foundation for some golf tournaments, you know, one-day charity events for White Sox charities. Space them out to whereas maybe we can do 6 or 7 or 8 of them throughout the course of the season. And the model of that, of course, is the Jimmy Fund in Boston, where they raise a tremendous amount of money, you know, to fight cancer in children. And they have them all over Massachusetts and New England. They have maybe 20 or 30 of those things a year. So
that's an idea that, you know, I can't play 18 holes hardly now because my wrists are bad. You know, too many strikeouts, too many fat sandwiches. So I just wore them out with that heavy bat that I used. And there are a lot of options that Scott and Bob and myself have been talking about. And it's going to be interesting and hopefully fun to explore.
You know, you're talking about the Holy Trinity there when you're talking about Scott Reifert and Christine and Bob Grimm. They are fantastic. And, you know, I was going to say, if anybody, you mentioned Jerry Reinsdorf, if anybody could talk about Reinsdorf, it would be you, Hawk. You've worked for him in a couple of different capacities. What, you know, I'm amazed, you know, because Jerry
always... Stay away from that one.
Okay, we'll stay away from that one. I know Ron Kittle wants to stay away from that one, but...
No one's perfect, damn it.
Hawk, you know, for a lot of owners to pull the plug on running for the title of the division and say, let's take it back, let's bring it back, the only way we're going to win a World Series is by being down low for a couple of years. Can you talk about how Reinsdorf, who's not getting any younger, really, you know, is kind of sacrificing a couple of prime years here to go for the glory a few years from now?
I tell you what, he's the youngest 81-year-old you ever want to be around. He's an amazing individual. I've met a lot of guys in my life, you know, from presidents to vice presidents, played golf with some of them, and, you know, met a lot of people, let's put it that way. I didn't think he was going to do it. We talked 2 years ago at the end of the season, and I got home and Eris, my wife, my beautiful Greek wife for 45 years, she asked me, she said, do you think Jerry's going to pull a plug on it? And I said, no, I don't. She said, why? I said, because, you know, let's face it, we're all getting a little long in the tooth. And he's so strong. It's just incredible. And he's not afraid of anything. He's one of those guys, you know, if you ever had to go to war, and I went to military school, certainly never, you know, been in action or anything, but you learn a little bit about the military, and if you ever had to have somebody that be in a foxhole with you, it'd be Reinsdorf, because they'd kill him. They'd have to kill him before he got to you. That's the way he is. He's loyal. He's one of three owners in the history of sports, not baseball, sports, to ever bring seven world championships to a city, and he's not done yet. I mean, he is not done yet. We're going to be. In my opinion, do we suck now? Sure. There's no question about that. And, you know, the thing about it is, but you guys know it, and I know it, and most of the Fox fans know it. This doesn't bother me. Do I like to see us lose? No. Do I like to see us make these young mistakes? No. But we've got the perfect guy running this club to get this thing on the right track. So in 2 years from now, and with the maturation process of a lot of the young, beautiful prospects that we've got, in 2 years, we got a chance to be a monster.
You hit on it just a second ago, Hawk, about how players today are better than back in the day. But on the other hand, you still would say the greatest baseball player you ever saw was Ted Williams. Am I right about that?
Well, the best, you got to categorize them. You know, Ted was arguably, you know, you got to throw Sam Musial in the mix in there, too. Ted and Musial arguably were two of the if not the two greatest hitters we've ever seen. Now, we didn't go back, you know, but for the last, you know, the last five or six, seven decades that I've been in this game, there have been some wonderful players. And those guys would be superstars today. They would be superstars 100 years from now. But what you just alluded to was the fact that these young kids coming up, I want to tell you, the best shortstop that I ever played against was Louis Aparicio. Louis was a wonderful player, a great shortstop, Hall of Famer. We've got five young kids in the American League today who are better shortstops than Louis was. I mean, it's just amazing how good these – I was, you know, just a little tick above average major league player. And the guys who were in my category, so to speak, they're so much better than we were now. It's been wonderful for me to see the evolution of the game and the way these young kids play it. And now, do they know the game? No, because they're getting to the big leagues so fast. If they don't have a chance to, you know, they don't have a chance to learn the game at the major league level until it's going to take a couple of years. And that's why Rick Renteria, to me, is just absolutely the right guy to be running the show, because of the fact the players love him, the organization loves him, he knows the game, He's a tough little guy. And, you know, we've seen that. He will jerk your ass out of that lineup in a heartbeat if you don't hustle.
Yep.
And that's the mark of a manager. You know, the mark of a manager is not wins and losses. The mark of a manager are your eyes. See how hard that club plays for him. Do they bust their behind all the time down the line? Do they hustle? Yes, ours do. And Ricky's boys don't quit. They're going to give him 27 outs. Now, the mark of a general manager is wins and losses because he's the one that puts asses in uniforms. So Rick can only run out there what he's got. But he knows what's coming down the road. He knows we got the Jimenezes and these guys and the Robertson. And we got some outstanding young arms that are going to be here. Right now, we're short. There's no doubt about that. But when we lose a game, it doesn't bother me. But when we won a game, I was really excited, like the one against Milwaukee yesterday, you know. They just play hard for him. And that's what Sox fans, you know, here in Chicago, you don't have to be a star for the Sox fans to love you, but you better bust your ass. And that's what our guys do.
Let's take a quick time out, and we want to come back and talk about your book, Hawk. Hawk, I Did It My Way, and it's incredible. I mean, I'm not the biggest reader of all time as far as books go, Hawk. I'm pouring through the pages here, and you've got a lot of really sensitive stuff in here that I'd like to touch on, you know, family and
sure.
Career and all of it. It's really a great read. So we'll do that coming on back here.
Are you the first person, Mark, from the University of Iowa to ever actually read a book?
Very rude. Not true. Great university. Go Hawkeyes.
That's cold. That is cold.
And just wrong. 720 WGN, it's White Sox Weekly. White Sox Weekly continuing. We got to call out Kenny Hawk Harrelson here. I mean, just a tick above average. I don't know, 1968, made the All-Star team, led the AL in RBIs with 109. That's better than a tick above average, Hawk.
Well, you know, I was in the category, so to speak, of a lot of our Sox players. I was young. I got to the big leagues when I was young, and it took me, in my first 4.5 years, I stunk. I mean, I really did. And, I mean, I could hit it. I was strong. I could hit it a long way. That's the reason they kept me up there. But then after you strike out enough and after you make enough mistakes, pretty soon you don't strike out quite as much. Pretty soon you don't make those same mistakes. And that's what our kids are going through right now. And we've got some wonderful, wonderful talent. Now, all of them are not going to make it. We all three of us know that. But if we just get 20, 25% of these guys that we've got, Rick Hahn and Kenny have done an unbelievable job of a redo. And as I said, we've got these young players that it's going to be fun. I think the next decade, after we get to 2020, I think the next decade here in Chicago of baseball is going to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest decade, because the Cubs are good. They're not going anywhere. And I'm glad of that because it makes us have to get better. And it's the baseball fans here in Chicago for the next 10 years are going to have a lot of fun watching a lot of exciting baseball.
We had it coming. We waited on both sides of town forever, Hawk. So
right.
we had it coming. So you know, you mentioned before that that Aparicio was the best shortstop you ever, you know, were on the field with, and now there's five guys better in the American League. Well, when you led the American League in RBI, when you crack 100 and then you lead with 109 RBI, you know, today there's so many guys that'll make a start for a team on the mound. You can't believe they got to the bigs. You were going up against the greatest, like, golden age of baseball, like some of the greatest pitchers of all time in 68. Did that baseball look like a pumpkin coming at to the plate with you?
Well, that was the year of the pitcher. That's when they raised the mound from 10 inches to 15 inches. And in 1968, that was the fewest runs to this day ever scored in one season in Major League Baseball. And, of course, when 69 came around, and they lowered it back down to 10 because the pitching was just so dominant. But, no, you know, what it is that you learn. It's an interesting process that you go through. I was in 1968, and I was 25 and a half years old when I almost won the Triple Crown. And that's pretty young. So how do you do it? So how do you stink for the first 4 years, 4.5 years, and all of a sudden – you become a guy who's contending for a Triple Crown. You do it because I didn't get any stronger. I didn't change my swing. I didn't know anything about swing angles or launch angles or velocity coming off the bat. What I did was I was talking with and getting experience. And I was talking with guys like Ted Williams and Al Kaline and these guys. Al Kaline was one of my idols. And you learn that you don't learn how to hit, or you don't try to learn how to hit major league pitching. What you do is you learn how to be dangerous against major league pitching. And I'll give you an example. What if I'm facing Corey Kluber or Jake Arrieta, and with that slider and that curveball they got, what am I going to do with that if they're hitting their spots? I'm going to grab some bench. I'm going to be 0-for-4. But the way I take that 0-for-4 is different than going up there just trying to hit the ball. You can understand. And Ted Williams told me that. He said, Hawk, there's going to be a lot of days when you go to that plate, you're going to be facing the guy 60 feet, 6 inches away who's going to be better than you are that night, and you have got to understand that. He said you can never reach your potential until you understand how to take an 0-for-4. And if you can do that, then you can grow. You can mature as a major league hitter. So when I was 26, I just applied. I went from mechanics, I went to approach. There's a huge difference. My thought process, my first 4.5 years, was from the plate back. After I got finished talking with Ted and Joe Cronin and some of these guys, my thought process went from the plate forward. So that means I'm not thinking about mechanics. I'm thinking about how can I be dangerous against a Corey Kluber, a Jake Arrieta, or a Lester, or one of those guys. And if you can do that, then you can start to grow as a hitter, and that's exactly what happened with me.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because in your book, and I want to get even deeper into this than what I want to ask you right now, but it's called Hawk, I Did It My Way. You talk about your temper a lot, Hawk, and when you're talking about it, you say, okay, I went 0-for-4 today, and not getting into the anger of it, but actually processing it and coming back out the next day. And you talk about how your temper killed your golf career as you were trying to become a pro after you played baseball, which is an incredible thing to try to do. But how did you, I guess, handle the fact that you did have a big temper, and yet you had to, like, come back out the next day and not let it get the best of you and be ready to go?
Through the process, through going through the process, I didn't have a bad temper. Hawk did. Kenny didn't have one. You know, he's the guy that got pissed off at everybody and everything and wanted to fight, and I didn't want to fight anybody. But Hawk did, and when he got upset, now in golf, in baseball, it could help you, because you're competing against another guy. I'm competing against a guy 60 feet, 6 inches, and I might be in a situation that my temper just, I couldn't, Hawk, he couldn't let it go. But in golf, the only person you're trying to beat is that mirror. And that mirror, if you get a temper on a golf course and you start going out with 14 clubs and you're coming back with 5 and 6, you can't beat those guys with 5 or 6 clubs because they're too good.
Sounds like Kenny was talking to Hawk at some moments. Does that make sense?
Oh, I talk to him all the time. I'm telling you. You should see some of the games. You know, I got this 100-mile drive. We live in Granger down here. And it takes me, hour and a half, because I'm not Ed Farmer. I don't drive like him. Ed Farmer and Don Drysdale were the two fastest drivers. I won't get in the car with Farmer. That's simple. But you got an opportunity to think a lot. And I tell you what, I used to love to listen to, you know, with Sirius XM radio. Now I can get games on the West Coast when I was coming home. And I used to love to listen to Vin Scully, you know, and Tom Hamilton when the Indians were out there, and Ray Fosse with Oakland. And you get a chance to think. And that really was a settling effect for Hawk and I. But on other certain days, I mean, we'd get in a conversation, and it was almost like, you know, he was one of my best buddies. And there's no question about that. He was. He was a big influence in my life. I used to sit in the on-deck circle a lot of times in 67 when we were running for the pennant, you know, when I was playing with the Red Sox. And Yaz would be at the plate, who Yaz to this day is the best 7th, 8th, and 9th inning hitter I've ever seen. And he won a triple crown in 67. And he was a motivation for Hawk to go ahead and try to win it in 68. And we almost did it, just, you know. And I'd be in the on-deck circle. Yaz would be at the plate, and I'd say, okay, if he pops up or grounds out, come on, Hawk, let's go. Let's get ready. We got to do it. And in 68, he did it. I mean, you know, he led the major leagues in RBIs, which in the year of the pitcher was, you know, quite an accomplishment. I didn't do it.
You did it.
He did it.
Boy, Mrs. Kenny must be much happier than Mrs. Hawk.
Yeah, for sure. So wait, I'm We got, but we have a situation here, as I said. You know, 3 years ago, Aris and I went over to do the game at the Cubs when they opened up their new stadium out in Arizona. And after the game was over, I'm walking out with my wife, and Theo comes walking by, and he says, "Hi, Hawk." I said, "Theo, I said, you just made the best deal you've made since you've been here." He said, "What's that?" I said, "Hiring Joe Maddon." He said, "Hawk, in your opinion, what makes him such a great manager?" I said, "It's the eyes, Theo. Watch how those kids will play for him. They will give him 27 outs a game." Now, the irony of what I'm saying now is that they let Rick Renteria go to hire Joe. And we have to happen to have, in my opinion, two of the greatest managers in the game of baseball. Because watch, the eyes will tell you how good a manager is, or bad. If those guys don't hustle, they don't bust their ass down the line, then you better make a change at manager. Because if he tolerates that, a team can be defined by the way they run to first base. An organization can be defined by the way they run to first base. And one of the greatest things I've ever heard, speeches by a Hall of Fame inductee, came from Robin Yount. He was giving a speech, and he said, "You know, people are always asking me how I wanted to be remembered in the game of baseball." He said, "I want to be remembered by the way I ran to first base." That's pretty profound.
That's awesome.
That is fantastic. Well, you know, if the eyes would make you a great manager, Larry Bittner should have been a manager. He's the only guy with double I, double T in his name. I would have thought he would be a great manager. Hawk, you know, Mark and I, our dads, you know, crazy coincidence, our dads went to high school together. They're both in their 90s. Your book, Hawk, I Did It My Way, is going to be my Father's Day gift to my dad. Now, we always loved watching you because in an instant, you would go from what a hitter's approach has to be in this situation, the way the pitcher's going, with, you know, a guy on second, with one out, you know, and into telling a story about Louis Tiant playing, you know, paddleball naked in the clubhouse moments before he was going to go out and pitch. Is your book like this?
Louis Tiant, one of the greatest teammates I ever had, I'll tell you what. He had these big Cuban cigars, you know. And he would get in the middle of the clubhouse with that paddleball, buck naked, in that big cigar. And he'd start jumping up and down. He had us in stitches. He had us on that floor rolling around. But he was one of the greatest teammates. And I'll tell you something else. In 1968, he set the American League record, which still stands for ERA, at 1.60. Because, as I said, that was the year of the pitcher. Bob Gibson did it. And in the National League, and it still stands. But Louis, but getting back to those good pitchers, I hit in my whole career against Louis when we were playing against him. I only had 8 hits off him. Okay, but 7 of them a home run. So when you get to that point, what does that tell you? That tells me that he was going to strike me out a lot, which he did. And I didn't get many hits off him in all those years, which I didn't. But the ones I did, I was dangerous against him, and that's why I had, of the 8 hits, 7 of the home runs. And that's what guys have to do. They have to figure out. Back in those days, the manager would tell you. You know, when I got traded to Cleveland from Boston, Alvin Dark, the first day I joined him, he said, "Kenneth," he said, "I don't care what you hit, but you got to," in Cleveland at that time was the biggest ballpark in baseball. He says, "You got to hit me 20 home runs, and you got to drive into 75 runs. If you do that, we got a chance." Well, I'm out of hitting 30 and driving, I think, 90-something runs for him. And that, they would tell you that, though. They would tell you what they wanted you to do. Today, that's not the case. And today, these kids, I feel a little bad for them because of the fact there's a place for numbers in baseball. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. Because what it does is it gives the fans a connection to the game, a bigger connection to the game. For guys who love the game of baseball and never played it aside and couldn't make it, they can still stay connected to the game. So there's a place for that. But to go to the extent that they're going now, inundating out of these kids with angles and numbers and all the stuff, sabermetrics, it just wears me out.
I think it wears a lot of people out. It takes away from the fun of the game, at least for some. Not maybe for everybody, but at least it does for me. Let me say it like that. Ken Hawk Harrelson, let's do one more segment with you if you have time. Is that all right?
Sure. I'm just getting watched. Tiger, get in. No, he just made a great chip.
I thought you were Are you a Ricky Fowler guy, Hawk?
He's my favorite. Ricky Fowler is my favorite. Ricky Fowler has got a chance. He's the closest thing, in my opinion, we've had to Arnold Palmer. And Arnold, of course, and I butted heads for 40 years, God rest his soul. And we had so much fun over those times and hundreds of times we played. And we all miss him at Bay Hill. I'll tell you that right now. It's just not the same. It's Amy and Roy, Amy, Arnold's daughter, and Roy Saunders. Sam's their son, you know, who's becoming a pretty good player out on tour. They're doing a wonderful job in perpetuating Arnold's legacy there at Bay Hill. But Ricky Fowler, to me, has got a chance to be the best ambassador for the game of golf, like Arnold was. You know, Arnold was not the greatest player. It's, you know, until somebody beats number 18 in majors, then Jack Nicklaus has got to be considered the greatest player to ever live. But Tiger, I'll tell you what, if he can come back, you know, look what he's done for the game. You know, when he came out, his first tournament was in Milwaukee, and I watched it. And I told Aris, I said, honey, this kid's got a chance to be the next superstar in golf. And boy, did he ever, because when he came in, ratings were in the outhouse.
Yep.
And they had lost a couple of tournaments. They had lost a couple of sponsors. And after 1 year, they got an exorbitant television contract, and they had to turn sponsors away because of Tiger. And now look at the resurgence of the gallery, so to speak, since he's come back after four back surgeries. And he's getting ready to putt right now from about 4 feet on a roll a second. Come on, Tiger. Knock it in.
Hey,
he did. Head center. Put it on the board. Yes.
I want to hear about Hawkisms coming on back here. It's White Sox Weekly 720 WGN.
Looking to play by Burley. Mercy!
You gotta be faithing me. What are you doing, Wagner?
You can put it on the board. Yes! Who wants to bunt?
White Sox Weekly, real treat this week. Getting to talk with Ken Hawk Harrelson for a good amount of time. Hawk, let me just start with your book. I open it up, and I'm not going to read the whole book here, but I was only 12 years old the first time a gun was fired in my presence. And you go on to talk about a relationship with your mom and your dad, who you don't even call your dad. Super vulnerable stuff, talking about how you actually had to hit your father because of what was going on with your mom. The choice to put it out there and being that open about your story and how it all shaped you, I'm curious as to how that all came to be.
Well, she was going to kill him. I mean, she always carried a pistol with her. Back in those days, that was not really an uncommon thing, you know. And she always had a pistol, so he was running around on her, and she caught him, and they got into a huge argument. And she went to get her pistol. She got it in her hand, and he ran over and grabbed her by the arm, and the gun went off, went into the ceiling. And when that happened, I hit him, and I was a big kid, and I was a strong kid, too. And I hit him as hard as I could. But, of course, at that age, you're not going to hurt an adult, you know, if you hit him. And I hit him as hard as I could. And then he looked at me and for about 2 or 3 seconds. And then he turned around, walked out of the house. And that was the last time I saw him until I got to the big league. And when I got to the big leagues, he called me. I was in Washington. We were playing the Senators. I was with Kansas City. And he wanted to see me. And out of curiosity, I said, okay. He comes over, the first thing he says is, I need to borrow some money.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I don't call him my father. I mean, he was biologically, sure. But my mom, there have been a lot of guys who love their moms as much as I love mine, but there's never been a son who loved his mother more than I love mine.
Hawk, today, if a 12-year-old were put in that predicament, there are people that are so well-educated and trained, counselors that would come in and talk to them. Back then, you didn't have that kind of access. What helped you get through that and move on?
My mom. My mom was not a book-smart person. She was a genius at common sense. And she raised me. She was making 56 bucks a week working as a secretary at a meatpacking company there. And I went to military school. And I got a scholarship to go. A guy paid for the tuition, the books, the uniforms, the whole, because it was a very expensive school to go to, and we certainly couldn't afford it. and they wanted me to come there. They had three high schools there in Savannah, and all three of them, you know, were trying to recruit me. But when you go to military school like I did for 3 years, there's three things you learn. The first thing you learn is that you don't care how big they are. The second thing you learn is that within reason, you don't care how many there are. And the third thing you learn is somebody's going to get knocked out because you're not going to quit. And those were the things that my mom just absolutely ingrained in me besides military school. So, in essence, I had two great psychologists, my mom and military school.
Would you... So would you say that, I mean, there's so much fear that goes on in the game and succeeding in the pressure. It sounds like you sort of learned how to deal with that in a way that you're just going to keep going no matter what the circumstances. Does that make any sense?
Oh, sure. Well, you don't quit. That's why Ricky is the guy for our team. Ricky is ingrained in these guys. Hey, you're going to bust your ass or you're not going to play. It's just that simple. I mean, because these kids today, some of these kids, you know, they're making so much money that if they don't like what a coach or a manager says, they just look at them like they're crazy and just turn around and walk away because they know they're not going to get a sit down. The only way you can really discipline, and there's got to be discipline in everything in life. The only way you can discipline guys is by playing time. And that's what Ricky has done with our guys. The guys just love it. I wish I'd have had it last year. I'm telling you, I can kick myself in the ass for not taking this picture. I went to the food room in Minnesota, and he was sitting there with Willie Garcia, Avi Garcia, and Abreu, the four of them, and Renteria. Those guys were laughing so hard. It was a beautiful thing to see. I mean, it really was. It was just a beautiful thing to see because he was the manager. Here's the manager with three of his players, and they're just absolutely having a wonderful time before a ball game. And you've got to have fun playing this game. If you can't have fun, then you're not going to realize your potential. One of the greatest things the player can have and retain is his childlike instincts, his childlike qualities. And with all these numbers that they're trying to inundate our players with now, the more numbers that come out and the more mechanics that come out, the more the childlike qualities diminish. And Ricky is trying to bring those back. He's trying to let these kids go out there and have fun because the three things that when I played you wanted to do, okay, this is the three in order, were you want to have fun because if you had fun, you had a better chance to win. And then the third thing was, well, just make as much money as you could. And that was in order. Today, it's money, money, and money with most teams. And Ricky is not in that zone. He wants our guys to have fun. That way they can retain their childlike qualities. They can go ahead and grow and have fun. Will they make mistakes? You're damn right they will. And when they do, he tells them about it. I'm not going to mention one player's name, but there's one guy, and this was last year. In fact, Ricky and I were talking about before the game. So he made a couple of mental mistakes in that game. So after the game was over, I went down in the clubhouse, and this was in New York. And there, the kid was sitting in Rick's office, and they sat there for like 20 minutes, and Rick was talking to him about it. Well, to this day, I have not seen that kid make another mental mistake. That's what it takes. And certainly with the Latin influence in the game today, bigger than it's ever been, and it's growing each and every year. They're almost 40% of the players are Latin. Then I've talked with Jerry about this and other people. You're going to see in the upcoming years, you're going to see more and more Latin managers. Last year, you know how many Latin managers there were in the game? One. And we had him. Rick Renteria was the only Latin manager in the game. Now, they got Alex in Boston. They got Davey in Washington. And you're going to see this trend grow because the Latin players are coming in, and they have paid the price down there. The Latin players have retained their childlike qualities and their childlike instincts better than our Caucasian kids. I mean, that's just the way it is. They down there, they play, they come, they grow up in a different game down there than we teach our kids here in the United States. They have fun down there. They have fun. They go up and they see ball, hit ball. They don't think about swing angles or other things. They just go out and they try to win a ball game for you. And that's what you're going to be seeing from the Sox. And I'll tell you what, it's going to be fun to watch. As I said, next 10 years in Chicago are going to be maybe the greatest decade in baseball history.
Hawk, I got to ask you about this game that we all fell in love with when we were kids. We live in a day and age where you get 6 mound visits, where if you slide hard, you're an SOB, and the commissioner of baseball is talking about robot umpires. Where are we with Major League Baseball in 2018?
I'm with you. I know where you're going with it. I'm with you 100%. I'll tell you what. You know, I was thinking about it yesterday. I was going over my iPad. I love my iPad. I'm going to work it. I know sending in, you know, but you can see what's going on in the world of baseball. And they had a picture of a great player, great catcher in San Francisco, Buster Posey. And when they put that Buster Posey rule in, I tell you what, it just floored me. And if you ask the guys today, my age or my era, so to speak, they'll tell you it's ridiculous. That slide is, they were getting on Rizzo about the other day. That's crazy. I mean, the man's got to try to keep his team out of getting into a double play. I applauded Rizzo for it. I mean, you know, it's just that's the way the game's got to be played. If a guy gets, when I try to score, if the catcher had the ball before I got to home plate about, say, 8 or 10 feet, what am I going to do, slide? We tried to run right over their ass. I mean, just run right over them. And in the game today, I mean, it's just not played that way because they won't allow them to play that way. And what they're trying to do with, you know, umpires, there's nobody. As much as I argued with umpires, it's my two rules in baseball, you heard me say. First rule in baseball, if you're going to win in the major leagues, you got to catch the ball. It's not hitting, pitching, you got to catch the ball. Because I don't care how good your pitching is or how good your hitting is. If you can't catch it, you're going to give him 30, 31 outs, you're going to get 27, you're going to get beat. And the second rule is don't mess with Joe West. You know, that's just the way it is. And I love umpires. They got a tough job to do. But do I think they're sacrosanct, that they're untouchable? No way, because they're a big part of the game. They have, umpires is like players. You got good ones, you got mediocre ones, you got bad ones. And they are a huge part of the game. We had a game. We had a couple of games in the last 10 days that we were taken right out of that ball game by the umpire. Now you got to live with it because it's not going to change. But when you start talking about robot umpires, come on, give me a break.
Besides, it wouldn't sound as cool coming from the broadcast booth. What are you doing, robot umpire number 3?
That's true. Come on, Mark Wagner, what are you doing?
Somebody's got to program that umpire. Hawk, let's talk about your Hawkisms for a second, because I got to be honest. I always thought, like, at least, you know, particularly like in the 90s, when you had the Big Hurt, you had Robin, you had a team that probably should have won a World Series if there wasn't a strike. But I felt like the White Sox were playing 10-on-9 with you in the booth. Like there was an impact, at least watching the game. And I don't know where you did it. Was it all just, it came through while you were doing games where you get that you could put it on a board and he'd gone and grab some bench, sit back, relax and strap it down. All of it was, did you think about these things beforehand or just come to you?
No, you can't do that. It's going to be spontaneous, you know, like the Big Hurt. You know, he had a streak there going and he was killing the ball. You know, first 7 years he was in the league, he was the best right-handed hitter I ever saw. And he was killing the ball. He hurt it. One day he had a home run, and I'm watching him go around first base, and it just blurted out. The Big Hurt. You know, it just blurted out. And I've had players come to me and ask me, "Oh, give me a nickname." I said, "Well, do something that calls me." But that team right there, yeah, you just hit a real touchy, sore subject with me when that strike. That Donald Fear, I'll tell you, he was a disgrace to the game of baseball. He absolutely did. He said it. He said, "I'm not a baseball fan." He wanted to make something of his legacy. And that's why that strike came about, because we had our Chicago White Sox and they had their Montreal Expos, the best two teams in baseball. And everybody was waiting to see those two teams butt heads in a World Series. It would have been something to see with those two great ball clubs. And Donald Fehr took that all away from baseball. And I tell you, if I had been a fan, I wouldn't have come back. I wouldn't have come back. And the irony is, you know what brought it back? Was the home run race between Sammy and Mark. That's what brought fans back to the game, because that old saying, you know, Wimpy's got a nephew who I love. I predict he may be president of the United States one day. We were playing golf at Michigan's golf course, Ann Arbor. And all of a sudden he says, you know, Hawk, he said, he's like 12 years old. He says, Hawk, you know, Ticks dig the long ball. And when Sammy and Mark, I love Sammy Sosa and Mark McGuire, I'll tell you, those two guys are two of them. When Sammy was with us, you know, I call him the Panther. He was just, I loved him. But he and Walter Reniac didn't get along. And, of course, when they called me and told me that they had traded Sammy for George Bell, I was so happy for Sammy, because he was not going to get along with Walter. Walter was not going to get along with him. And Sammy was regressing, so to speak. And, of course, after he left us, then, you know, it's all history now. And Mark McGuire is one of the sweetest people you ever want to He's like a big cubby teddy bear is what he is. He's not as big as Frank Howard was, but Frank was the same way, unless you pissed him off. And Mark's the same way. But those two guys, when they got hooked up in those two home run races, that brought the fans back. But that 94 season, that was such a disgrace to the game of baseball.
I mean, the White Sox almost did it in 93. I still think they should have come back and beaten the Blue Jays in that series if they had started out a little more confident. Hey, Hawk, do you think the steroid guys should be in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Really?
Yeah. You got Mark McGuire. Well, he was taking the androstenedione. That was legal when he was taking it. Plus, he had plantar fasciitis. Okay? I've never had plantar fasciitis, but I've had some friends that had it, and they say it's one of the most painful things you can go through. And he was doing that for the recovery so he could play. Mark McGuire did not need any strength. He didn't need to hit any further, not 1 foot further. And Mark should be in there. And then you take Roger Clemens, who's a Hall of Famer. I don't know Barry Bonds, and I don't want to know him. I've never heard a person say a good thing about Barry Bonds, okay? But as far as a player, he might be the greatest player we've ever seen. He might be the greatest player we've ever seen. He was a Hall of Famer before all this, before his head started to grow.
It's true. He was.
But Clemens, you know, these guys, they deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. Now, are they going to get there? I'll guarantee you, it might not be in my lifetime, but I'll guarantee you they will get there because of the fact of what they did. And I'm a big proponent of era in Hall of Fame picks. What you did in your era, not what you did stacked up against guys who played 20, 30, 40 years before you. What you did in your era, were you dominant in your era? If you were dominant in your era, then you should go to the Hall of Fame. And that's exactly what these guys were. They were dominant, Clemens, dominant in his era, before the Juice, dominant in Rafael Palmeiro. What a hitter he was. And I just can't believe that the hypocrisy, so to speak, is going on. Anything you see in society, okay, you're going to see in sports. That's the way it is. Anything you see in society, you're going to see in sports. And we've had, I guarantee you, I can't say this for sure because I don't know. But I'll guarantee you in other occupations, even in politics, I'll guarantee you we've had some guys who were on juice or other, let's say, supplements, so to speak, that we'll never find out about. But the thing is that these guys were Hall of Fame players. Barry Bonds, as I said, you ask anybody. I asked a guy who managed Ken Griffey Jr. when Jr. was in his heyday. He had 54 home runs that particular year that I'm talking about. And I asked a guy who knew Barry Bonds. I said, who's the best player? I thought he was going to say Junior, you know. He said, no question about it. He said, Barry Bonds. He said, it's not even close. And when you say that about Ken Griffey Jr., you know how great a player is.
Hawk, you know, my last question, I'd love to ask you for baseball advice, but, you know, a small percentage of the world will ever get to do what you did, play Major League Baseball for a living, whereas many of us, get married. So you've been with the same wife for 45 years. Give us some marriage advice.
I'll give you the greatest piece of advice I got about that. If you ever get in an argument with your wife, don't win it.
You sure? Really?
Don't win it. You get into an argument. And the guy who gave me that advice was Reinsdorf. He's still married, I don't know, for 60 years or something. He said, Hawk, if you ever get into an argument with Harris, don't win it. And I say, you know, it's a two-way street, boys. Two-way street. You know, and how you preface that question was, guys who love the game but never played it. Let me tell you something. Some of the best baseball people we've ever had in this game never played the game. Some of the best baseball minds we've had in this game never put a jockstrap on. They love the game. They knew the game. They studied the game. The fans are so sophisticated today as compared to 40, 50, 60 years ago. It's not even close. We got people sitting in the stands who can run a Major League Baseball game as well as a lot of managers. Running a game with the X's and O's, you know, X's and O's in football are very important. X's and O's in basketball are very important. X's and O's, and my favorite sport really is hockey. X's and O's in hockey are very important. X's and O's in baseball don't mean anything as compared to those other sports. What means something in baseball is getting what's in the team out of them. What's getting out the talent, getting out the desire, getting out the don't quit attitude. And that's why I brought up that phrase with Ricky. Ricky's boys don't quit. And they won't quit. As long as you see Rick Renteria managing, whether it's the White Sox or the Yankees or whoever, you will never see a team of his quit, just like you will never see a team of Joe Madden's quit. You'll never see a team of Mike Scioscia's quit. Bruce Bochy. Those are your managers. Bobby Melvin. Bobby Melvin in Oakland, one of the most underrated managers in the game. Those kids don't quit. They bust their ass for him. And that's the mark of a manager.
Hawk, it was a true pleasure to talk to you today. We look forward to doing it again soon. And we're going to miss you when you're gone at the end of the booth here, but we're hoping you'll be around the park. And we're looking forward to every Sunday broadcast you got left as well. And the book, again, is Hawk, I Did It My Way. We barely even touched on it. Honestly, it's a phenomenal, phenomenal read.
If you don't buy it as a Father's Day gift, you're going to think to yourself, I wish I could cuss.
Well, I got to tell you this. Sometimes you can't believe when the inning was over and I hit my call switch, you can't believe the words that came out of Hawk's mouth.
I can't believe it.
But, the guy who wrote the book, Jeff Snook, he did an unbelievable job of research. He came out with some stuff that I hadn't even thought about or heard about in years and years and years. So the response to the book has been phenomenal, you know, with Amazon and Google and all these other places giving us five stars. And then the people who read it, it took Reinsdorf 2 days to read it.
Wow.
And, so it's just been phenomenal. But Jeff Snook really deserves a ton of that credit.
Well, Hawk, I mean, you're a treasure, man. You really are, and incredible credit to the White Sox organization and baseball, and also it was great to talk to you today. We appreciate all the time. I know it was a long interview, but we loved every minute of it.
Well, for you guys,
thanks, Hawk. You're awesome.
White Sox Weekly,
all right,
White Sox Weekly, 720 WGN.